Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my email in question. My girlfriend and I listen to you on the radio, and she respects your opinion as I do. So here's the question. I've been separated for 9 months. I'm working on a divorce. Is it okay to date? I believe it is. But she's not comfortable with being around people who know my divorce is not final. Can you help? He kind of answered it when he said, if she's not comfortable, it's not a good gig. And Pat, you have some questions about dating?
I am 58 years old,
and
I've been divorced for years. I was watching the Oprah show the other day, and they were talking about...
They were talking about sexual desire.
How does that factor in if you're after menopause?
Obviously, being postmenopausal, you know, you aren't going to have the same pheromones, but then the men you're probably going to be dating, they're not going to have that need to mate with you, for children. How do you feel about hooking up with somebody else?
To bring Carol to your station, call John Quick at 317-432-0309. Available as a long-form talk show and in 60-second infomercials for even more revenue opportunity. Carol the Coach, truly refreshing radio, enriching the lives of your listeners.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
You know, I love that promo because it really does finish up by saying, we own the power. We own the power
to make life our own. And, you know, as a coach, what I really believe to be true is that we are 100% responsible for our behavior. And that means that we absolutely have to take responsibility for what we've done in our lives, who we are, and who we're going to become. And so I am here to tell you, there is no doubt in my mind that it's so important for you to really believe that you can change your life. If you're a sex addict, then you got to know that this show is about figuring out what coping skills are available to make your life different. And if you're a partner, if you love a sex addict, then you got to know that no matter what has happened to you, you got to figure out what it's going to take to improve your self-esteem, to improve your ability to handle triggers, and to take the bull by the horns and absolutely make it your own. And I know that that's really tough, and you may not have been with anybody who's been able to show you how to do it. So tonight, if you're an addict, this show is going to give you hope. And if you're a partner, this show is going to give you skills. You know, as a coupleship, you have been through an amazing experience that has provided lots and lots of trauma and anxiety. And now, as I said to you last week, safety and stabilization for both of you is very, very important. And for the partner, you have to grieve and mourn what you thought you had and grieve and mourn what is happening today. So that truly, one of the things that I want to tell you is truly what you have to be able to better. You will feel better. You have the power to make your life so much more manageable than it feels right this minute. And tonight we have Michelle Safier on, who's an LMFT. She's a CSAT, who's an expert in helping couples heal. You know, she believes that couples don't know how to be in one another's presence because of all the trauma that they have experienced. And so she's going to talk about, you know, how do you deal with your feelings? How do you contain your anger and fear? How do you talk to each other? How do you behave in front of the children? And how do you cope with the level of distress that the sexual addiction has caused? She helps couples experience a deeper relational healing through the process of reconciliation, which is that third stage and phase of partner trauma. First is safety and stabilization. Second is grief and mourning. And third is what we call restoration. And Michelle calls reconciliation. So I'm super excited to have her on because we want to give you hope, strength, and recovery. That is the tagline of this show. And that's what we believe to be true. Now, for addicts out there, it can be very difficult to really empathize with the partner. You may think that you're empathizing, but in reality, you're probably only doing that half time. And what I mean by that is that, for instance, I was talking to an addict the other day, and he went past an acting out partner. He was walking past her. And she was with a friend of his, and he said hello to them both. And my partner that I work with had entered an agreement with him that said, you will not talk to any acting out partners. Now, from his point of view, he hadn't talked to her. He had acknowledged her and kept going. You know, he didn't stop. This was great, great, great improvement in the eyes of the addict. But from the partner's standpoint, he had failed her because he had not done what he agreed to do, which is absolutely not acknowledge her at all. And so there was this rift between the two of them. And I totally understood that. And so my work was to help the addict know that despite the fact that he was the new and improved and had made a 95% improvement in his behavior, it wasn't good enough to make him feel safe and stable. And I think you can understand that, can't you? As an addict, you get that he let his wife down. He did not follow through with what he agreed on. Yes, he was new and improved. Yes, he did much better, but it wasn't good enough. And as an addict, you really have to, as you are working on your relationship, you have to be able to do it 100%. And when you do it 100%, you make your wife or your husband feel safe. But if you don't, then I got to tell you, there's so much more that you will need to do. Because you got to do it perfectly. That may feel very unrealistic, but it is exactly what you need to do. So, here's the deal. I have to tell you, there is no doubt that I can help you to do it the right way. I can help you to learn how to do it perfectly. And I know you may say, I'm not perfect, but I'm telling you, if you've made an agreement, you've got to do it well. All right, so here we go. Empathy means that this man had to look at his wife and say, you're right, sweetie, I did not do it the right way. And I am so sorry. I am so sorry that I didn't do it perfectly. And I will do what it takes to make it better. And she may be angry that you missed your opportunity, but we'll continue to work on that. And I definitely believe that you can do it. That's, as an addict, what I believe you can do. Why? Because you want to make things right. You want to restore your relationship. So what do you think? Do you feel like you can do what it takes to establish safety and stabilization in the coupleship? That's the big question. And if you're a partner listening, do you have the patience to help him or her to do it the right way? That's the important part. Do you have that down? Can you realize that he's a work in progress? That's the big question. So you tell me, how flexible are you as the addict and how flexible are you as the partner? That's the question of the day. You tell me. That's what I really want to know. And I do absolutely believe that when there's that desire, we can make anything work. But empathy for the sex addict meant that he had to understand that even though he was the new and improved and working really hard and way better than he used to be, it still wasn't good enough. And he had to work on making her feel safe. So, okay, that's what I want you to think about. Think about the last time you didn't do it exactly right. Or think about the last time that you wanted your partner to get it. And, well, partner as in the sex addict, you wanted him to do it exactly right and he didn't. And you felt betrayed. You know what I mean? Okay. And tonight we're going to learn all sorts of things to get this arranged in a different way. Because I'm telling you, when two people love each other and when they are wanting to make things work, then I'm here to help you make it work. And that's the hope, strength, and recovery in the relationship. You are listening to Carol the Coach. This is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And tonight again, I have Michelle Safier on, and she is a CSAT who's an expert in helping couples heal. You know, she feels that couples don't know how to be in one another's presence, and she helps them to figure out how to cope with the level of distress that they feel and how to experience a deeper relationship healing through the process of reconciliation. So I have to welcome Michelle to the show and let her know how excited I am, because truly I feel as CSATs, and I'm part of APSATs, the partner training program, I feel like this is our mission to help couples heal because they've been through the utmost of trauma. So Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And boy, you have taken on a big job because you are really working with couples to navigate the journey out of the disease world of sexual addiction and into the healthy and robust life of relational wellness. So first and foremost, tell me what made you go in to this business.
Oh, boy, that's a very good question. I actually stumbled upon this work 21 years ago while working in an office in Los Angeles and meeting Rob Weiss. So he was sharing an office in the same building, and we had a few conversations, and he sort of said, hey, you know, come in and do this work. It's read this book, Out of the Shadows, which was one of a few books at the time. And the journey began. And I'll tell you,
well,
Carol, when I start, pardon?
Well, I was going to say, and we've had Rob on the show. You know, he just wrote the book Out of the Doghouse, and he was talking about how addicts can make their partners feel better. And that's kind of a new spin for Rob, even though he's always been partner-sensitive. He's really talked with the addict himself about his addiction. So it was real exciting to hear him work on this new partner-sensitive book.
Yes, and relationship-sensitive book. And I agree with you. When Rob and I started doing this work together 21 years ago, boy, we worked with partners as if they were co-addicts, you know, codependents, and helping them to identify their own, quote, acting out behavior and, you know, checking and asking questions and so forth. And what we, of course, realized very quickly was, you know, these folks were in pain. And what they were doing was necessary for their survival. So,
yeah, and, you know, certainly with my partner training, what I know to be true now is that it's probably not a good thing to call them co-addicts, but to understand that they are experiencing trauma from an illusion that they thought that they had. And certainly you are really sensitive to that.
Oh, my goodness. They're an illusion, absolutely. The folks I work with are deeply, deeply traumatized by what they've discovered. And, you know, at one time back, you know, in the beginning of this work, we, in the same way that we might have seen, you know, alcoholics or chemical addicts, that the partner may have sort of known or seen, you know, some of the signs. Certainly you can smell it on the breath. You can see the dilated pupils when it's drugs and alcohol. But what we know is this is a very secret and in many ways sneaky disease. It's, you know, we can't smell it. There's no, isn't overweight. It's insidious. And so most of the partners that I've worked with over these years had really no idea what was going on and the life that they built, the years, the memories, the children, the struggles, the joys, were genuine and real for them. And the distractiveness or any of those symptoms that we now realize were part of the addiction, you know, seemed like work-related or career-related or the normal distractions and stresses that we feel as part of a family. So this is very deep. And, you know, Carol, one of the things that I've realized that actually someone said to me, one of my partners said years ago, she said, you know, this trauma, there's nothing really else like it or any other way to describe the profound nature of it other than it's sort of similar to child abuse in a family. You know, when there's abuse in a family, the healing process is geared toward reunification of the family so that the person that's been harmed is living with the person that's harmed them with the expectation that they will move forward as a family. And boy, when you think of trauma, that's really profound. I can't imagine a situation where the person that you've trusted the most, it has not only harmed you, but that you're continuing to live with and work toward reconciling and toward a loving relationship with the very person that's hurt you.
Well, absolutely, and that was a great analogy because certainly I worked with sexual abuse in a county program for 6 years, and what we knew to be true is if you could keep families together, that was typically in their best interest, but part of that process required that you made sure that they were safe, that no more further abuse was going to occur, and that they could begin to restore a relationship that was actually even better than before. So now tell me, Michelle, I mean, in working with couples in early recovery, do you have a roadmap or a treatment plan that you present to the couple?
I do, Carol. I find that it's very important when the couple comes in, and, you know, they're in crisis, of course, the partners, on the one hand, feel like, I don't know how to breathe. You know, their world is so upside down that even things like, how do I breathe? What's the next step I take? And the addict, of course, is so shamed and in despair and paralyzed that these folks come in and it feels, you know, in many ways life-threatening. And so for me, I find that having a very clear roadmap, I'm direct, I talk a lot, in the beginning of the therapy, I educate them about sex addiction, about the dopamine push that comes with sex addiction, about post-traumatic stress disorder, and in particular that all of what looks like snooping and checking and questioning is a desperate attempt to find some safety somewhere, something to hold on to. And I actually also talk about success stories. So I will share a story or two of others I've worked with in the past that have gotten through it. I find that the couple needs an anchor. They need me to be an expert. They need to feel like they're walking into a therapy room with a therapist that's not going to say, well, that's normal, or, you know, kind of get over it, or what's wrong with the relationship. They need someone to acknowledge that this is frightening, this is real, and there's hope. There's a fix. There's a cure. So I talk about, you know, there's a recipe. Patrick Carnes, his task model, there's a recipe. If I do this and this and this, then I can get well. And if the partner can observe her husband doing those things, then she can feel, he or she can feel the hope in that. So I talk about my experience.
Talk a little bit about that. I'm sorry. Talk a little bit about Patrick Carnes' recovery model and some of the things that you do.
Well, I'll tell you, I start the first session. We begin talking about, in very concrete terms, what the first seven tasks of recovery are. So within that first session, the addict has a list of meetings. And I'm kind of particular. I want to say I'm controlling in the beginning as best we can, in that I want to direct the addicts to meetings that I know are good, strong meetings, and start them. I have them walk out the door with Out of the Shadows and Facing the Shadows, which are Patrick's books that sort of break denial. And I, if possible, I can connect the addict with someone who is in sobriety and who's held themselves out to be a sponsor for newcomers. So I like to make those connections. And for the, so in terms of the task model, I want them out of their feelings and in their heads and in action, going to meetings, talking to other men, having an anchor even in the 12th step, someone that they can meet at the meeting, that they know that they will meet there, having finding that sponsor, making the phone calls, and most importantly, committing to their partner that they will do whatever it takes, which the way I sort of present it is it's, you know, it's not a buffet. We don't get to choose. That if you want to save your marriage or relationship, that the addict has to do whatever it takes. I'm very clear about that. So in addition
and you know,
to that,
I'm so glad that you kind of talked about those recovery tasks because I too, you know, when we first learned, because we both went through our CSAT with Patrick Carnes, and his recovery task model, obviously that first task is about breaking denial. And so
right.
It sounds like you really helped the sex addict to understand what denial is and to understand how insidious the sexual addiction is. And then that second task is about understanding addiction and sexual addiction specifically. And so that's where they get to learn about, you know, what problems has this caused, what secrets have occurred, how much has this cost you emotionally, financially, physically? And so they really start to get a good handle on what their behaviors are and how they've supported those behaviors in secrecy. And it sounds like your roadmap helps them to go through, well, a course of treatment that includes all of those recovery tasks. And so your treatment approach is really very much based on Dr. Carnes and his work, correct?
Absolutely. I find that in the beginning stage of couples healing that all that the partner has to depend on is the behavior of the addict,
uh-huh.
right? Words don't mean anything. There's I'm sorry and promises are empty. But I ask partners as best they can, I sort of say, sit on your hands and observe. Just watch. And the addict is, you know, I find, Carol, and tell me, don't you find that, you know, they're in denial that they're in denial?
Yes, absolutely. They are so in denial, they don't even know they're in denial.
Exactly. And so reading out of the shadows and doing those tasks, understanding what your triggers are, acknowledging the secrets that you've told yourself as well as others, because you know in order to advance the addiction, one has to tell themselves all sorts of secrets. So they've harmed themselves as much as they've harmed their partner. And that's a key, that's difficult for partners to understand in the beginning, of course, but for the addict, that's an integral part of their recovery, is understanding and accepting how they've put themselves in harm's way and how not to do that again. So I think of that beginning stage using the Carnes model in Facing the Shadows, it's relapse prevention, but it's also kind of waking up. You know, in Buddhism, there's this concept of sort of being in a slumber. And, you know, this opens one's eyes. You know, you wake up. And what they wake up to is the harm that they've caused, the wasted years, the lost years, children that are grown, you know, it's devastating.
Well,
and
absolutely.
So,
and, you know, when you're talking about coupleship, you know, it's very different for the addict versus the partner because, again, the partner is kind of an innocent bystander in most cases to this. And so would you say that handling feelings amongst an addict and a partner can be a tricky situation?
Well, absolutely. In that beginning stage, you know, both are dysregulated. In other words, I find often in the coupleship that the partner is what we call hyper-aroused, in a state of hyper-arousal, which is really post-traumatic stress disorder. So they are, you know, a bundle of nerves. They are watchful of everything. They don't sleep. They're questioning. They're suspicious. They can't calm down. Whereas the addict is what we call hypo-aroused. So it's almost as if there's nothing. There's no emotion. And which, of course, in a coupleship dynamic can be infuriating to a partner because they can easily interpret that as he doesn't care, this isn't a big deal, he's, you know, the expectation is that he can, or he, the addict, he or she, should empathize and should feel the feelings, match the feelings, but that's not the case. And they are both in deep trauma on opposite sides of that spectrum. So feelings are loaded, and expressing a feeling is loaded. Now, in relationship, I talk about, you know, this is the work of one's life. This isn't a part-time job or a hobby. The addict who has spent much of their life, as we now know, medicating feelings in one way or another, and you know, for those who have masturbated, we find they've masturbated for much of their life, and that was their earliest coping mechanism. So we are asking someone who has developed a habit of self-soothing and medicating to step up to the plate, to face into their own reality of their destruction. Their eyes are open. The destruction of their the pain and hurt caused by the betrayal. Children, job, if that's a problem, the pain of the partner carrying the secret, because you know many people don't want to talk about this. They're embarrassed and ashamed to talk with family, loved ones about their partner's behavior. So they carry that burden as well. So I find in that beginning stage, I want to help the couple to just notice the feelings, notice the sensations, how to regulate themselves, how to bring themselves down if they are feeling hyper aroused. You know, they're in a fright state, fight or flight, right? And to help the addict come back up out of checking out, out of dissociation. I also find, Carol, that keeping them both in their heads, reading, learning, and as best they can, staying away from that empty, open, non-structured time where all they've got is their pain, I find just sort of helps them through that beginning process.
Well, absolutely. And so what do you do to help a couple feel safe?
So to help them feel safe where there's no safety, I find that helping them to feel like they found the right place. So I'll talk about Patrick Carnes and about what sex addiction is and the neuroscience of it, what happens in the brain. And I find actually that just kind of going back to that, the therapist understands. In traditional psychotherapy, we want to be mindful of presenting ourselves as the expert. That I know how to handle your problems. But because we want to empower clients to be their own experts. That's ultimately the goal of therapy. But in the beginning of this particular treatment, the clients need to know that the place they're coming is a place where they're understood, where they're not shamed or embarrassed. And I find that presenting that expertise and that information helps them to feel safe. They feel like this person understands this is real. This isn't, I'm not crazy, I'm not bad, I'm not unlovable. And so talking about what the nature of this is, and I also spend time talking about what is post-traumatic stress disorder and what are natural reactions to a life-threatening situation. And I don't know about you, Carol, but in my experience, boy, when a partner discovers something, it feels life-threatening. The life they had is not what it was. Everything has been taken away in that moment. So validating that on the therapeutic level, on a concrete level, I give them a lot of tools. So I teach breathing. I teach them how to help themselves feel safe when they're outside the therapy room. And there's a particular breath that I find helpful called a vagal breath. And it is just simply putting your hands on your diaphragm, on your stomach, and just taking a breath so that the diaphragm extends. And that's an immediate tool that can help to calm someone down. And just in that regulation, there's a sense of safety.
Well, that makes sense. You know, it's so interesting that some of the simplest tools can really make the biggest difference in our central nervous system and in our amygdala, which obviously is that part of the brain where you go into flight, fright, or freeze. And so obviously when you can keep channels open and breathe through it, you begin to feel grounded and stable. And for partners, that is the first step to feeling safe and stable. And I was telling my listening audience before you came on that that's the first phase of helping a partner to recover, is to help them feel safe and stable, even while they're discovering more and more information that says, wow, a lot of my life was a lie and I didn't even know it.
Right.
So now, how do you think disclosure fits into the process of the coupleship? And how do you facilitate that disclosure?
That's a very important question. Mm-hmm. Disclosure is an integral part of the healing process. And so for me, that initial crisis phase, which we talked about, is the starting point. And if we can help these folks journey through that crisis phase, as you've mentioned, you know, explaining not only post-traumatic stress disorder in theory, but what's happening in the brain, in the amygdala, the cortisol, all those chemicals that keep people overstimulated, agitated, and what that shutdown is, that if we can help them pass that crisis, and by the way, I have to say, I rely heavily upon inspirations, affirmations, essential oils. You know, there are wonderful homeopathic rescue remedies. Don Miguel Ruiz, the Four Agreements, those are important tools to help someone just get through that crisis phase. And when they've navigated through that, we begin to talk about disclosure. My personal experience, or my professional, I should say, experience, not personal, professional, is that we want that to happen within the first 6 months. And in my experience, I like to be mindful that the addict is capable of honesty. And, you know, they were in denial. So coming out of that denial, coming out of that slumber, I find that one is more able to be honest with themselves and then be honest with their partner. So facilitating disclosure too soon is, in my experience, there's a greater likelihood that all of the information isn't going to come forward. And, you know, with disclosure, we don't want this to be an ongoing process of dropping bombs. So for me, it's important to assess that there's stability, that the addict is in a recovery system, that the partner has support, and then we begin the process, which for me, although it's a thoughtful and complex process, it really boils down to the addict writing a sexual history timeline, all the behaviors, the frequency of the behavior, and the money spent. And I like a time, I'm visual, so I like to see it on paper. And I find that for the partner, when they can see a timeline in 1980, they can begin those puzzle pieces, those floating parts, quite knowing what was going on, you know, those little questions. It all begins to make sense when they can see it in front of them. So I have the addict do that timeline. And also, in preparation for the disclosure, I have the partners write a list of questions. Whatever. Exhaustive list. Doesn't matter how long it is, of course, we go over it so that the language is optimal for honesty. So, you know, we want to remove any blaming, shaming, any language that would prevent the partner from getting what they need. And for the partner, I ask them to write an impact letter. And the impact letter essentially is, this is what it's been like for me from the first minute, the first hour, the first day, the first week, the first month since I discovered. So that the addict is, let me say first, Carol, I see disclosure as being for the partner. Secondarily, it helps the addict because honesty is part of the program, and, you know, their healing depends upon their honesty and transparency. But it is the first, the beginnings of the reconciliation process. In order for reconciliation and forgiveness to occur, the betrayer needs to humble themselves with contrition, with humility, with honesty, and offer the full extent of their harms, their wrongs. In order to right the ship, one has to admit the wrongs. So the addict presents that, answers all of the questions, and then I have the partner read that impact letter so that when they leave the session, and then we don't process it or discuss it, but when they leave the session, of course there's pain on both sides, but we leave the session with the addict holding and bearing witness to the pain that their behavior has caused to their partner. And that's a beginning of a forgiveness process.
Oh, that's a very, very good point. And so then, where does disclosure fit into the process of working through and developing trust and understanding? You know, do you have to be able to work on forgiveness?
Oh, yes. Well, I find that trust is concrete. It is in action. So behavior, consistent behavior over time is the most important element for trust building. And disclosure is the, that's the backdrop from which everything moves forward. So without disclosure, how can one, and what's essential, how can one forgive, I was going to say. And I find that in that disclosure process where the couple is sitting, you know, knee to knee, facing one another, and the addict is looking into the eyes and saying, here's what I've done to you, that really can begin a healing process. That in that moment, the partner can feel seen and valued for who they are. And also in that moment, the addict looking into the eyes really of their beloved can understand and begin that process of compassion and empathy for what I did to the one I've loved. Whereas, you know, in addiction, one is in that sleep. One is disconnected. An idea of intimacy, an idea of partner, but not an eye-to-eye, heart-to-heart, soul-to-soul reality. So that's essential to the trust building. And, you know, there is not a trust and forgiveness. It's as individual as the person. I wish I could say there's a timetable you have to, you know, in which people forgive. But it's a fluid process. And, of course, one element is what's the level of pain caused? Not based on behavior, not based on addiction behavior or acting out behavior. It's the extent of the lying, the extent of the hurt, the gaslighting, the twisting reality and twisting words and blaming. So the trust building and forgiveness process is connected to the level of harm. So there are times that we wade deeply into the harm. And in that process, I may, for instance, do an EMDR session within the couple's session where the addict is observing and witnessing the pain of the partner. That increases compassion. And done respectfully, it can keep the shame at bay. And, you know, shame is natural. Shame is can can heal us, can guide our moral compass. So we don't avoid shame. It's part of the deal. We invite it into the room. We know it's there. But we walk through the pain, and the couples therapy process is a deep healing process for both, because there's a time when the addict may do EMDR and the partner who's been the betrayed is bearing witness to the pain of the addict, and that's where deeper forgiveness and this exoneration process can begin.
Well, yeah, so then, you know, obviously a lot of people wonder, what is exoneration? And it sounds like it encourages the couple to forgive and forget. And how would you clarify that, Michelle?
Yeah, I think there's no forgetting in this. We would never wish for someone to forget, right? We are... Head may not hold these pains, but our body and our heart does. So in no way is an exoneration process about forgetting or getting people off the hook, although I think that's a fear that partners have, that if I forget, there's no forgetting, if I forgive, that in some way I'm giving a pass or saying it's not that bad or you haven't hurt me. But actually, there is tremendous strength, dignity. It's heroic and noble to begin this process of exoneration, exoneration is a process. It's forgiving with understanding, with compassion. So forgiveness, really, when we talk about forgiveness, it's not forgetting. Forgiveness releases the person that's been harmed from the burden of carrying the pain of that harm throughout their life. So forgiveness is, as we say, it's an inside job, right? It's not, it doesn't involve the betrayer. It is a process through which the person that's been harmed allows themselves to understand the humanity for themselves and for the betrayer, so that they can be free from the entanglement of anger and revenge. Exoneration is a coupleship process. It requires, first of all, the betrayer to acknowledge guilt, to have sincere remorse and repentance, and begin to offer restitution. What can I do? Whatever you need. The betrayer acknowledges the injustice and there is a process in exoneration where one begins to understand how the addict came to do what they did, right? So how did they get there? Forgiveness alone doesn't heal a relationship. It can heal the heart of the one who's been harmed, but it doesn't heal a relationship. So for the relationship healing, the couple endeavors to understand how the addict came to do such behaviors, because we need to honor and understand the humanity in all of us. So to stay in the anger keeps the addict in a, you know, quotes, sort of monster position. You're the bad guy and you've done bad things and you're bad. There's no healing in that. And we know
what would you say that the sex addict can do, you know, in the midst of exoneration? What can he or she do, mostly he, in terms of their attitudes, beliefs, and behavior? What should that sex addict be doing?
Oh, well, what I ask them to do on a concrete level, I ask them to do a check-in every day so that the addict comes forward and checks in with, I am sober, here's the meetings I've gone to, here's how I'm feeling, here's how I'm doing. And to be honest, with thoughts or slips or any of these things. And just the addict coming forward is a huge step toward the exoneration and the healing process, because, you know, it takes that responsibility off the partner to wonder if they're safe. So that's one issue. I ask the addict to transcend. It really requires them to transcend their own hardwiring to avoid and to disconnect, and to ask daily, how are you doing? How are you feeling? To have gratitude, to express gratitude to their partner and also to themselves for whatever, for their partner remaining there, for, you know, waking up and breathing. So gratitude's checking in, doing their 12-step work, doing whatever the partner needs to feel important and valued and respected. Even if that means, for some people, phone calls. So calling when they get to work, calling when they're, you know, all of these little things which may seem unimportant and one can easily forget are all the building blocks of trust and relationship healing. And
yeah, I agree. It's kind of the footprints of what they need to do to right the wrong and establish that trust, safety, and stabilization.
Right. And, you know, Carol, one of the tools I use, drop the phone, I call an intimacy rating scale. And so I have a list of maybe 25 behaviors that I think about in terms of intimacy. Have I listened to you? Have I asked you how you're doing? Have I expressed appreciation? Have you felt important? Have I left you feeling like you've been understood? A list of a bunch of necessary caring behaviors. And I will ask the addict to give it to their partner and have their partner rate them on a 1 to 5 scale with their experience of the addict. And then I will ask the addict to rate themselves. And so that's an important tool in helping the addict with their self-awareness. How am I doing in this process of reconciliation? How am I doing in this process of restitution? And for the partners, again, they feel my partner cares enough about me to rate himself, to hear and to read about how I experience him or her. And, you know, there's a vulnerability in that, and it's uncomfortable, but that's another step toward healing. And I will have couples read books, read inspirations.
So let me ask you, as we begin to end, obviously, if people would like to work with you or consult with you, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, I have actually, and there's one other thing I'd like to mention. I didn't realize we were coming to an end. I have a website, and it is traumahealingpa.com. So that's the immediate connection. And there's a lot of information on that website. And I wanted to mention, I am in the midst of a project which I would like to invite your listeners to, and I, of course, will send you information.
You know, I just reread this project as I was going through my emails. I think you talked about this 4 months ago. So, yes, talk about that partner project that you've been diligently working on.
Thank you. So it is called Show Your Work. And the inspiration quickly is a partner that I had worked with for years who recently passed away. And at her memorial service, her children talked about her. She was a math teacher. And she would kind of, sort of, you know, in math, the teachers talk about showing your work. You know, don't just answer the question, show your work. And this woman lived her work. She, in the midst of her pain, she reached out to others. She was vulnerable, accepted help for others. And so she brought healing to many, even in the midst of her own pain. So what that inspired this initiative is calling, asking of partners who have been on this journey to write their story, to not just the story of how awful it was, but what their journey to wellness was. So what did they do? What books did they read? What helped? What prayers? Or did they do art? What help? Giving, sort of paying it, giving back, not even paying it forward, but as one leaves this process and is on that lovely, beautiful road to wellness and healing and robust relationship, how did they get there? Because there are others that are coming behind them that are lost, that are in that beginning crisis phase and don't know how to breathe. So
what are you asking for people how can they contribute?
They can find information on my website, traumahealingpa.com. I'm asking people to send stories, letters. I have some women that have sent their artwork, that have sent inspirations, written their story, poetry, whatever has helped them. Something that they themselves would have wanted to hear, would have been a lifeline for them. And the hope is that this can all come together into a book or some sort of informational piece that partners on the beginning of the journey can hold on to, can get them through.
Well, and you and I both know that so many of our partners and addicts have a lot to contribute when it comes to their writings, their poetry, their drawings. And so, again, if a partner has something that they believe could be therapeutic for someone else, they can reach you by contacting you at and fill in that website for me.
TraumaHealingPA.com. And my email address.
That website. Yeah.
Correct. And my email address, which is on the website, is msaphir@traumahealingpa.com. And they just simply can submit whatever they have, either by mail or via the email system. And, they are including their voice. They're offering their voice and their wisdom to others who are beginning the journey. And
well,
Carol,
I love
whatever
that. When you submit this stuff to Michelle, I want you to remind her that you heard this on the show and you thought as a partner that you could make a difference. And so that's very important. We all have a lot to give, and we all have an ability to express ourselves in many, many ways, whether it be song, poetry, project, art, writings, chapters, books.
Right.
So feel free to let her know where you heard about this project. And Michelle, this is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. Now, will this be anonymous for our partners?
Most certainly. So their contributions will be anonymous, and scriptures, healing books, any wisdom. Carol, our partners are experts.
Mm-hmm.
They are the experts. I'm on the journey with them, but they have the answers. They have the wisdom. And
I so agree with you. And go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say, Carol, that they, in this process, they then become the sage. So, you know, the sage, the one who's gone through the painful journey and has learned the lesson and then can help others.
That's right. And a sage is actually someone who is very, very wise because they've learned through experience. So,
exactly.
Michelle, thank you so much for contributing. You know, you give the coupleship hope, strength, and recovery that people can get through this, especially when there are tools. And so they can get a hold of you through your website, and they certainly can submit their projects. So, again, I can't wait to see you next year in 2018
yes.
at the ITOP conference. And thank you again for being a contributor to this show.
Thank you, Carol, so much for having me. And thank you for doing this show. It's a great healing for the community to have you here.
Thank you. You know, I absolutely love it. And my listenership, the addicts and the partners contribute so much to it. You know, they email me. They contact people in their own state. They get the help that they need. And so we're making a difference, and I appreciate you being part of that difference, Michelle. You have a great week.
Thank you. And you as well, Carol. Be well.
You too.
Thank you.
All right. So, again, that was Michelle Safier, and she has made it her mission to help couples work through the trauma. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. So I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. And if you have something to contribute, again, I highly recommend that you do so. And that's by getting a hold of Michelle. And if you need her website, because it is a website where she takes projects and contributions, you can contact me at Carol@CarolTheCoach, and I'll pass that forward. So we'll see you next Monday night, 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, p.m., for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach. See you next week.